the spirit of prophecy words it. It is very powerful language here. But because of the time, I summarized it somewhat. So we read here on page 280 in the second paragraph, a legal religion can never lead souls to Christ. Now compare this with the statement that the law is our tutor to bring us to Christ. Do you see that these are two different sets of statements that seem to oppose each other, and yet they don't. A legal religion can never lead souls to Christ. But the law is our tutor that brings us to Christ. So the law is not a legal religion. These are two different things. The law can be used as such a thing, like a legal religion, and then it becomes a curse. You see, this is the point. Now, I tried to put this down in a diagram. Sorry, that's not the diagram. Here it is. First of all, the statement in Galatians chapter 3, the promise was given to Abraham, and then 430 years later, so here that's the promise to Abraham, and 430 years later, the law was given where? On Sinai. That's right. It's difficult to write like this. Okay. Now, 430 years after Abraham, this situation came. For what purpose was the law given? To lead us to Christ and to keep us. We were kept under guard by the law. We were kept under guard by the law. How long? Until the heir should come. Until the seed should come. And when Christ has come, we are no longer under the tutor or the pedagogos, as we will see, that's another word for it. It's a Greek word. You can learn this. The Greek word used here is pedagogos. That's right. I will come back to this. But let's first come to another diagram. I ask the question here, is the law the tutor that leads us to Christ? Is it really the tutor that leads us to Christ? Really? Now let's look at a legal religion. Does a legal religion bring us to Christ? No. Leads us away from Christ. A legal religion does the opposite. It does not bring us to Christ, but leads us away from Christ. Okay, when a legal religion leads us away from Christ, what do people then conclude? Therefore you must throw out the law. And without the law, you come to Christ, they say. But this is not true, because lawlessness, where does it lead to? Also away from Christ. I think we understand this. A legal religion leads away from Christ, and lawlessness also leads away from Christ. So what do we need? We need the law as the tutor, or the pedagogos in Greek. And this law as a tutor leads us to Christ. And that's the text in Galatians 3, verse 23 to 25. But before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for the faith which would afterward would be revealed. Now, I think the greatest point, the most important point, at least to me in the last study, was the fact that a legal religion is a comforter. I never saw it this way. But that helps really to see what it is. It's a false comforter. The real comforter is the Holy Spirit. And this is a false comforter. Lawlessness is also, you can say, a false comforter, because people say, oh, I don't need the law. They comfort themselves by cheap grace, so to speak. Don't keep the law. You will be saved anyway. That is a comfort for them, but it's a false comforter, isn't it? So everything that is a false comforter leads away from Christ. Now, what leads to Christ? We need to study this now and understand it now. For this purpose, let's come back again to the scripture in Galatians chapter 3, verse 23 and 24 and 25. But before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for the faith which would afterward be revealed. Therefore, the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ. Now the word tutor here in Greek is paedagogos. Now that's a very interesting little footnote here in the New King James Version. You will probably have it in yours. In a household, the guardian responsible for the care and discipline of the children. Now the word paedagogos was a very known word in the time when Paul wrote this letter. It was not a strange word somehow. It was not a strange function. Almost every household had a paedagogos at home. That was usually a slave, and this slave was responsible for the discipline and care of the children. Of course, they had probably more children than we have in the average today. You know how it is. When you have one child, it's quite good. You get along very well. You have a second child, you can manage because you have two children and two parents. That's okay. But a third child, then the children are majority, and that's dangerous. Because only two parents with three children, you always have to jungle around. I mean, one has to stay in the air while you keep two in the hands, so to speak. But four and five, I mean, you need a guardian. You need a helper, somehow. And six and seven. I marvel at some believers who have so many children and who still manage well. That's quite a talent. So, the point is that in those days, they had a guardian at home. He would also lead the children to school. And he was not the teacher, but he would lead them to school on the way, protect them, and make sure that they make their homework and so forth. And when they were at school, he handed them over to the teacher. Then his job was done. Now, in the Greek art today, you know, they make excavations and they find old vases and old pictures. How was the paedagogos always presented? Always as a man with a stick in his hand. That's interesting. So, whenever you see in an old Greek picture a man with a stick in his hand, you know, aha, that's the paedagogos of the family. That's the one who disciplines the children, the guardian responsible for the care and discipline of the children. So it was a known function back there. As today, you can say, we don't have servants so much nowadays, do we? The labor is too expensive. So
nannies,
that's right. That would be the equivalent of it. In a household, the guardian responsible for the care and discipline of the children. Now, why was he represented with a stick? Because he was responsible for the discipline of the children. And the stick was used in order to discipline them. Now, a good guardian would not, of course, beat them blue and green so that they would obey only from faith, but he would use the stick wisely. Fear. Obey from fear. What did I say? Fear, not faith. That's right, thank you. I used the wrong word. A good guardian would rather create faith in him so that they would obey from that motive rather than from fear. Now, that Paul should compare the law with that guardian, with that person, is quite interesting, isn't it? Is the law really a discipliner? Was the law a discipliner when it was given on Mount Sinai? For sure. You see, God really impressed upon the people his holiness by giving them the law. They were not to touch the mountain. There was a fence around it so that they would not touch it and die. There was a tremendous glory around it. There was an earthquake. There were lightnings. Moses was in the middle of it all. When he came down, his face shone with the glory. Now all this impressed to the Israelite very deeply how holy the law is, and how serious it is to transgress it. This is necessary. We need it. It's a necessary discipline so that we are led to the right track. You see, God could say, oh, it doesn't matter whether you steal from your neighbor or not. The main thing is that in the end you are saved. It's not working like this. We first have to see the seriousness of the transgression, and therefore we need a very clear vision of the law. We need to see how serious sin is. We need to see it in its full light. That's necessary. It's a part of the healing process. If we avoid that part, we won't get a complete healing, you see. We need that part. It's shameful, it is fearful, almost you can say, when this revelation comes, but it is necessary for healing. Every physician, when he wants to heal, he has sometimes to inflict pain. Have you got some massage from Klaus when he was here? Who has got some massage from Klaus? Now, tell me, was it pleasant? Afterwards it was.
Yes.
The result was pleasant, but when he met you, was this pleasant? Right? So likewise, is our great physician, he has to give us these revelations in order that we wake up and see what sin really is. It's a part of the healing process. That's really necessary. Well, if we know that a loving hand afflicts us to us, when we know it's a part of the healing process, then we can accept it, isn't it? If you hadn't known that Klaus is a physician and wants to help you, you wouldn't have endured it. Just somebody coming and beating you is another thing than if it's a skilled physician who helps you. So God applies this. Now, this has two functions. Number one, to separate us from sin, to show us how grievous sin is. And number two, then to keep us. And number three, I should say three functions. And number three, after we are kept, to lead us to Christ. Now there are many instances where Christ healed the people from sickness and from sin. Was this usually the first time that Jesus worked for the people? The answer is clearly no. Even though the Bible doesn't tell us much of the fore history of the people who were afterward healed, there is much, and the spirit of prophecy tells us some things. For example, the paralytic who was lowered down the roof, what was the history before he came to Jesus? It was a history where he suffered very much under the burden of his sin, where he saw the sinfulness of his sin and really was crushed. And he wanted to have help. And for this he was wanting to come to Jesus. You know, his sin condemned him. And he was so happy when he was lowered down the roof and Jesus said, "Thy sins be forgiven thee." He didn't want more. That's all he wanted. That was the main thing for him. And then he got healing of his physical malady as well. So that is the forehistory. You see, it was not suddenly Jesus saw him and then he was healed. Jesus had worked for him all the time before. And this Jesus did again and again. So we wrote down here, the law as the paedagogos, the law as the discipliner, is Christ for us. You see, it's still Christ who works. But in this case, it's Christ for us. He works for us. He cannot work in us yet, because our heart is not renewed. But in this time, he works for us. He prepares the way. And he leads us to the stage where he can work in us. Sorry. You see this difference? Christ for us and Christ in us. It's both Christ. I mean, the law as the tutor is also Christ, really. Because it was Christ who drew this paralytic to him. Nobody else. And Christ worked through the law, because it was necessary that the man first saw the guilt of his sin. Now, let us think a little bit further. In what way can we apply the paedagogos today when we work for other people? What is the right method to be followed in the application of the discipliner? We must be careful not to fall into a legal religion, of course. You see, to apply the law to people until they are dry, like the mountains of Gilboa. On the other hand, lawlessness is not the alternative. So how do we apply the law properly when we want to help people? Let's take a practical example. Here is somebody who is dependent of drugs, of alcohol, of nicotine. Okay, he's a dependent. Now, what can I do in order to help him? First of all, I can do nothing unless he wants to. That is the first rule, absolutely the first rule. Of course, I can, I shouldn't say nothing, I can pray for him, I can show him that I'm willing at any time to help him. I can stretch out my hand and say, "Here it is, my helping hand, if you need it, you can lay hold of it and we can go along." That is possible. In other words, show a willingness to help him, that is clear. But beyond this, there's nothing you can do. You cannot support him in his addiction, because if you would do this, you would do more harm than good. You cannot hide his addiction, and behave as though he didn't do it, again, you would do him more harm than good. And this is the problem of the co-addict. He is trying to help the addicted person by allowing him to continue to take his comforter. That is the problem. But this false comforter has to go away. That's the only way you can help him. And that's hard, because it creates a conflict. The person wants to cling to his comforter. He says, that's my comfort. That's what I need. And then you say, sorry, that's not what you need. That's a false comforter. And then the conflict starts. You see, the helper sometimes is in an awkward position. He wants to help, but he can't, because the person clings to his wrong comforter, to his bottle, so to speak. So you stand and wait, and you watch. He falls lower and lower and lower and lower until he comes to the point where he's absolutely broke, where he's at the point where he sees that his comforter is a false comforter, where he actually sees it. And that may take some time. Let's take an alcoholic. He will always feel that he still has control over his habit. And he gives you proof of this very often by discontinuing drinking for 3 months. And then he says, look, I'm quite good. I have it under control. That's the proof he gives to you. I know I have it. But every alcoholic can do this. After 3 months, he continues again. And this is a matter that goes on and on and on. And until he comes to the point where it becomes so bad and so obvious that he can't hide it anymore, he loses his job, he loses his family, he loses his friends, he loses his self-dignity, he loses everything. When he comes to that point, then is the time where he really says, no, I need help. I need help. And that is the time where the helper must be ready. He must be there. For that purpose do we stretch out the helping hand all the time. For this very purpose. Then is the time where we need to tell him, well, we need to separate you from your comforter, from your false comforter. That's the only thing we can help. And you know, when somebody is very miserable, that's the point where he really says, yes, yes, I'm willing. To really be willing to be separated from your comforter requires a lot of strength. And this strength you get only when you are absolutely on the bottom line. It sounds contradictory, doesn't it? But that's it. People won't do it unless they are totally disillusioned from their false comforters. So, at that time, what do I do next? Now comes the paedagogos. Now comes the application of the paedagogos. And what does it practically mean? Well, I tell to the person, first of all, give me a wallet, please. No money. Absolutely no money. I have to be rather tough. It's not easy, but you have to be. Of course, it must be, every step must be absolutely in consent with the person. You can't be successful if you do it against his will. He must be in consent. Make a contract before. Say, look, I want help, and I'm willing to submit to everything that you say to me. And then you say, okay, you specify. First, the wallet must be handed over. Second of all, you must leave your living place and live with me for the next unspecified time. And I determine when it's time for you to go back. So you stay with me. Number next, you can't go out without anyone. Whenever you want to go out, have somebody with you. Number three, and so forth. In other words, you put a lot of restrictions upon him, which is quite something, isn't it? It's in a way humiliating. But can he be more humiliated than what he has revealed already? You see, that's the point. He's willing to do this if he sees how degraded he is by the false comforters. But before this is not obvious, he's not willing to do this. So he has to give all these things away. And then, after this happens, then you begin to give him good food, give him encouragement, and you lead him to Christ by making daily worships with him, by pointing him to Christ and telling him that he's the only one who can deliver him from these drugs. We had a very wonderful experience, which I very briefly want to relate to you. In America, this year in the East, we met a sister who in the past year had weighed over 400 pounds. I forgot now exactly how much, 490 or 480 pounds. that is 200 and something kilogram, and the size of her is about this. Now, can you imagine? But and from childhood on, she was fat and fat and fat and fat, and it has become an addiction to her. She stood before the congregation and she said, "I have an addiction. My addiction is food." Very openly, she said this. My addiction, it's obvious, but she said it. My addiction is food, and I need help. And then believers took her into her home, took her on a diet, which was hard for her, you know, to cut herself off from her comforter. And food was her comforter, literally. But she was willing. She agreed to this. Then they went for walks, for daily walks, mild exercise, which then became more and more. And there was a regulated day schedule, getting up early in the morning, then regular meals, and everything was regulated. But she was willing to submit to this. What was especially hard for her, and she related this to us, was the walk uphill. They went on a hill, and that was hard. After every step, "Oh, I can't. And then, you know what the believer said to her? "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Okay, next step. And again, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Next step. "I can do all things." And so, with every step, they repeated that promise until she was on the top. And then she was relieved. She related this experience first. I really liked it. You know, that was a tutor to bring to Christ, because it was connected with Christ, who is the one who delivers us. And when I saw her this year at the camp meeting, she weighed only 200 and something pounds. She lost about half of the weight. She looked very different. You wouldn't believe that. And she was so happy. She was saying, I was so blessed. You see, she had to be under a tutor, and the tutor was connected with a helping hand. She was willing to submit to this, but it meant a restriction. And now she was feeling much, much better and getting over this. Of course, she's continuing this program. It's not finished yet. And she must come to the point where she doesn't need the tutor anymore, where she, of herself, can say, "This food stays where it is, because it's not mealtime. And when I eat my portion and not more." She will be able to do this because Christ is the one who delivers her. "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." That is the message she gets now, with every step of that pedagogos. So, it is Christ for us, the law that brings us to Christ, and that is not legalism, you see. We really have to see this point very clearly. Also, very often in the education of children, parents had this trouble. They wondered themselves, "Well, my child is not born again yet. What shall I do with it? It's not born again. I shouldn't beat it. I shouldn't force it to do anything. It's not born again, so I can't make worship with it either." That's what parents tended to think. "So I simply have to let it run around until it comes and wants to be born again." But it never happens. So it gets worse and worse and worse. It's an awkward situation, isn't it? Now, what do children need when they are not born again? If they are not born again, I say. What do they need? They need the pedagogos, clearly. And the pedagogos is the one that leads us to Christ. They need somebody to lead them to Christ. And that means the man with the stick. Of course, a loving application of the stick. That is clear, but it is discipline, definitely. And we really need to understand that it is the law that leads us to Christ. I would call it a loving but firm guidance. But again, I want to stress the fact that it works only with the agreement of the person, only with his consent. Otherwise it doesn't work, even with a child. So I have to win the child to agree to that style. And you can, as a parent, I believe you have means enough that you can do this. Every parent should have enough means, unless the children are too old. But, I mean, I wouldn't go into detail now, but there are 1,000 ways to really win over the agreement of a child or even of a young person if we put ourselves on a level with them. But we must be very clear, there needs to be a pedagogos in the home until Christ is there. Now, what is true for our rebirth experience is true also for every step of our reformation. When there's a sin, and we have the matter not in the heart yet, what do we do in the meantime? You see, some people say, I don't do it because I don't have it in the heart. And they will never do it. For example, yeah, I should eat healthy, but I don't do it because I don't have it in the heart. Therefore, I continue to eat my junk food. That's what they say in America. Do they say this here too? They call it junk food. That is unhealthy food. Dog's food or whatever they call it. Okay, so I still eat it because I don't have it in my heart. Why should I be a hypocrite? Here I eat my meat and my sausages and so forth. I don't have it in my heart. That's simply so. You can take this attitude, or you can take the attitude, well, it is true, I don't have it in my heart, but I will accept the loving hand of a Paidagogos. Sister White put it like this. When she was becoming a vegetarian, she was putting her hand on her stomach and she said, stomach, you won't get meat. You see, she had to really discipline herself in this regard. Now, it is best when we can discipline ourselves, but in the some addictions, it is not possible that we discipline ourselves. Alcoholism is one of these things. You simply can't. It's impossible. You need a helping hand. And Sister White describes this in the book Ministry of Healing. And the helping hand must be there, must be wise, and it must be the Paidagogos. And it must be strict. That's important. We must not give way sometimes, and then we are strict again and give way again. That doesn't work. You have to insist on very stern measures when the problem is so great as it is. Of course, the more there's a victory over the sin, the more the freedom can come back again. We had a brother who stayed with us who was having this difficulty with nicotine, with smoking, and that was hard for him to give me his wallet. That was a real struggle. When I said, give me a wallet, he almost stepped out of the program again. But I was hard. I said, well, do you want to be helped or not? And he said, okay. And then he gave it. I kept it not for long, but until I saw that he really was free enough to take it again. But there were other measures that were still taken. And even to this day, we have him with us, simply in order to help him to fully grasp the power of Christ. And when Christ is in the heart, he does not need the Paidagogos anymore. Then he will go out and stay for himself without that problem. Now, can you understand Galatians 3, verse 23 to 25 in this light? Let's read it again. But before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for the faith which would afterward be revealed. Therefore, the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. You see, it is faith that helps us. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. That doesn't mean that we are from then on lawless people. Clear. Because we have the law in the heart, you see? That's the point. Then we are no longer under tutor because the law is in the heart. So, this then leads us back to Ephesians chapter 3, verse 14. Was it 14? I think so, yes. Ephesians chapter 3, verse... 2, verse 14. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 14. And I think we understand this better now, especially verse 15. For he himself is our peace, who has made both one, and has broken down the middle wall of separation, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is, the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so as to create in himself one new from the two, thus making peace. So what has Christ abolished? Yes, according to what we have studied here in the diagram. But not the Paidagogos, no. He has not abolished that. What did Christ abolish? What was the wall of partition that separated us from another? Legal religion, that's the point. A legal religion. That, in this case, is the law with its audiences, you see. The Paidagogos is not separating us from God, but it's leading us to Christ. But the legal religion is separating us from Christ. Is this clear? The Paedagogos brings us to Christ, or the tutor, and the legal religion separates us from Christ. So the legal religion is the wall that needs to be broken down, not the Paedagogos. Okay? For he himself is our peace, who has made both one, and has broken down the middle wall of separation, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is the legal religion. That is the effort of man by his own works to earn salvation. That is the wall of partition that has separated us from God, and that had separated Jews and Gentiles. Literally true, isn't it? So this is the context, very clearly. And that he might reconcile them both to God in one body through the cross, thereby putting to death the enmity. That's real enmity. Legal religion is enmity. And he came and preached peace to you who were far off and those who were near. For through him we both have access by one Spirit to the Father. By the way, I feel slowly a little bit hot here. I don't know how you feel. I hope. Is this okay? I think the air would be a bit fresher. So, let us now, in our last minutes that we have together here, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 4. No, 1 Corinthians chapter 4. The first letter to the Corinthians that Paul had written was an answer to a certain problem that had arisen in the church. What was that problem? Do you know? It was a party spirit that had arisen in the church. Some said, I belong to Apollos. Others said, I belong to Peter. Others said, I belong to Christ. Others said, I belong to Paul. So it was a split church in that regard. Now, who was the one who brought the gospel to the Corinthians?
Paul.
Okay. Paul describes this work of bringing the gospel to people as a birth process. To the Corinthians and also to the Galatians, Paul says, I have begotten you. Which is quite interesting, isn't it? Now, what is connected with the birth of a child? Pain, clear. It's the first thought that comes. And so it is also in the spiritual. When Paul was giving birth, when he brought the message to the people, it was under much tears and prayers. You know, it's always painful when you see people making decisions against and others coming through much struggle and accepting the truth. Or accepting the truth and then being persecuted as a result of this. Or then accepting the truth and the marriage breaks up as a result of this, and so forth. That is horrible. That is hard to bear for a messenger when he brings the message somewhere. So this situation he faced, and that is pain. What else is involved with begetting a child?
Nourishing
and feeding, and also bringing to life, isn't it? And so the one who brings the message to them is in a special way connected with these people. Like the mother, in a special way, is connected with the child because she has given birth to it. In this very chapter, in 1 Corinthians 4, Paul says that he is their father. Also, to the Galatians, he says, I'm begetting you again, a second time, because they had fallen away from him. Now, he bore them again, so to speak. Okay, let us read the role of Paul here, and we also find the role of a Paedagogos, very soon described here. Now, the reason why we study the role of the law and the Paedagogos is in connection with walls. We want to see how Paul was breaking down walls. You see, the point is this, that Paul was the one who brought them the gospel, but other people came and were puffed up, as he says, exalted themselves, in other words, and these people began to philosophize. They began to start with other philosophies and ideas, and these philosophies and ideas put the gospel that Paul brought them in a secondary shell, so to speak. Yes, Paul had some good ideas, but now we must go on. And you know, Apollos, he has some very good thoughts. And you know, Kephas, when you read his letter, you see that it is advanced to that what Paul writes. You know, Paul's is a little bit blurry, but Paul's letters are very clear. Well, James, he's writing just to the point, isn't he? His thoughts are very deep. Oh no, Apollos, he's a real scholar. That are the best thoughts. And so they were discussing like this, you know, and the message that Paul brought was rather unimportant, becoming more and more unimportant through these problems. And now Paul had to fight against it. He had to bring them back the gospel. He had to break down that wall that was now erected between him and the Corinthians, between the father and his children. How does a father break down walls that exist between him and the children? Let's look how Paul did it, shall we? Let a man so consider us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required in stewards that one be found faithful. But with me it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or a human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. For I know of nothing against myself, yet I am not justified by this. But he who judges me is the Lord. Therefore, judge nothing before the time until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the hidden things of darkness and reveal the counsels of the heart. Then each one's praise will come from God. So, let a man consider us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. That is the introduction. What was Paul? Just a steward of the mysteries of God. And the main point is that they are faithful. Now, the Corinthians judged him. And when scholars, students or pupils judge their teacher, what does this mean? That's right. You see, if I say that's a good teacher or a bad teacher, how shall I know? He hasn't even taught me everything. If I say after the first few studies he's a good or a bad teacher, I first have to wait until the course is finished. And then I can say whether he's a good or a bad teacher, whether I know my subject or not. But to say it before means I exalt myself over the teacher, and that's what they did. Now, these things, brethren, I figuratively transfer to myself and Apollos for your sakes, that you may learn in us not to think beyond what it is written, that none of you may be puffed up on behalf of one against the other. In other words, the message that Apollos and that I brought to you, I see the time is over, the message is not our message, it's not our deep thoughts, but we just faithfully transmitted to you what God gave us to us. We are just channels. We are just communicators. And this puts the thing in a different light. I'm sorry we have to close here. I recommend that you finish this chapter. Maybe we have still some time. This evening or tomorrow morning, we'll see what happens. To read the rest of this wonderful chapter. It's really a very interesting chapter and shows how Paul really broke down walls between himself and the children that he had born. Okay, so we have to close. Do you have any questions so far? Emil? The tutor is not the legalistic religion.
No, I'm saying that we have the legal religion and we have the lawlessness that take us away from Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So the tutor is there to bring us to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Does the tutor continue to lead us with Christ?
When we have Christ in the heart, we don't need the tutor anymore. You see, we, for example, the law that says you shall not smoke, we don't need it if we don't have smoking in us. It's not necessary, because it's in our heart not to smoke.